Okay. Thank you, Leon. So I guess my talk fits appropriately in an afternoon session, which is more geared at materials. It's going to be a theory talk, all right, but with significantly less exotica than what we had in the previous couple of days. Okay, so what I'm actually going to talk about is interplay of orbital degrees of freedom, structural degrees of freedom, and correlation effects in various materials, specifically in some D1 transition metal oxides, titanates and vanadates. And I'll show how actually the mechanism behind the metal-insulator transition in this material is actually driven to a large extent by the lifting off of orbital degeneracy, and how, by the same token, this sort of unfortunately ruins some interesting proposals for orbital liquids in these materials. Then I'll turn on to a second material and a second topic, which actually motivates the title of my talk about Morten Pryor's meeting, which is this vanadium O2 material, which definitely has a lot of the Pryor's phenomenon present in it, but has remained a controversial case for many years, and we think we now understand what's going on in these materials. And I was also planning to talk about an even more intriguing situation, which is this barium VS3 system, which is definitely a Pryor system, but I guess I won't have time to talk about that in the same talk. Let me acknowledge my collaborators, Silke Biermann and Frank Lechermann, who are at École Polytechnique, and Alexander Poterjaev from Nijmegen, who will move to École Polytechnique as a postdoc, Eva Pavarini from Pavia, Alexander Lichtenstein, who recently moved to Hamburg. Yeah, that's probably better. And Ole Andersen, who is, as you certainly know, one of the fathers of electronic structure calculations in localized basis sets and has been very inspiring for us in this work, which really brings together electronic structure and correlation effects. And as a matter of fact, at least the first half of the work that I'm going to talk about in the first half of this talk started right here in Santa Barbara about a year and a half ago when we organized this workshop about electronic structure and correlations.
That was realistic vis-à-vis.
Exotic.
Exotic, right?
I was not going to bring.
Any new term.
I was not going to bring that terminology issue, but I'm not surprised you do it, Shankar.
Realistic exotic.
Okay. So let me introduce you to this family of D1 perovskites. Specifically, I'm going to talk about these four compounds, and you're going to see quite a bit of electronic of crystal structure in this talk. So let me go slowly through these ones, which are definitely the simpler ones of the materials I'm going to talk about. The simplest is actually strontium VO3. This is a very standard perovskite structure, which has oxygen octahedra surrounding, so the black dots here are the oxygen surrounding vanadium atoms, and these oxygen octahedra pile up like this in a perfect cubic structure. This guy has no structural distortions. It's a perfect cubic symmetry structure with the strontium sitting in between the octahedra. As we move along this series, which all have nominally one electron per transition metal ion, something happens, which is that there is an increasing crystal field, crystal structure distortion. So this guy is not quite cubic, and these two are certainly not cubic at all, but this crystal structure distortion is actually mainly a tilting of these oxygen octahedra like this, while that's known under the name of gadolinium iron O3 distortion, while the oxygen transition metal distances remain pretty much equal, not quite equal, a few percent difference, but basically that means the Jahn-Teller distortion of these octahedra for all these compounds is actually very small. The main distortion is actually this tilting. And this is something that was overlooked for many years in the theoretical understanding of these materials, because since the immediate neighborhood of these transition metal ions remains sort of octahedral environment with very little Jahn-Teller distortion, it was assumed that thinking about these materials as perfectly cubic was okay. And this is actually how this story about orbital liquid started. And I'm going to show you that this is actually incorrect and that this tilting distortion is playing a very important role. The basic fact about this, so let me, right. So what is this tilting doing? Well, first of all, when we have the pure cubic structure without any tilting, of course the five-fold degenerate d orbital is lifted as in a cubic oxide with octahedral environment into a low-lying triplet, which goes under the name of T2G, and a higher-lying doublet, which goes under the name of EG. And in these systems, we basically have one electron, which is in this T2G multiplet, while the EG multiplet is completely empty and plays very little role. As the system is tilted away from the perfect cubic structure, there is a further lifting of the degeneracy of this T2G multiplet, which is due not so much to the change of crystal, to the change in the crystal field due to the surrounding oxygens, but actually to the cation. So for example, in lanthanum TiO3, to the fact that the lanthanum no longer sees really a cubic environment, and that lifts off the triplet degeneracy of the T2G orbital. That was first emphasized by Mochizuki and Imada and plays a quite important role, as you will see. So the basic observation is that among these four materials, we have two metals and two insulators. The strontium-calcium VO3 compounds are metals, which I would characterize as sort of intermediate, moderately correlated, while these guys are definitely MOT insulators with gaps that are quite different for these two materials. In fact, lanthanum TiO3 is an insulator with a very small gap, which is about 0.2 eV, and it's very sensitive to oxygen stoichiometry. You can even drive it metallic very easily if it's not carefully prepared, while yttrium TiO3 is a good insulator with a gap of about 1 eV. For a long time, this was analyzed as being just due to a change of the effective bandwidth due to the tilting of this octahedra. But what I'm going to tell you today is that, in fact, the real mechanism behind this difference of behavior of these two family of compounds is really the fact that there is a lifting off of the orbital degeneracy, which is very strong for these two materials. And we know that as we decrease orbital degeneracy, the critical value for the value of the critical coupling at which you enter the multi-insulating phase goes down. So the higher the degeneracy, the higher is this critical coupling, so that we believe this is the driving force for the fact that these guys are metals and these guys are insulators. This is actually an observation about the high temperature state of these materials, which are MOT insulators even at room temperature. Of course, as you go lower in temperature, these two materials order, and they actually order in very different ways. They are the lanthanum TiO3 orders in an antiferromagnetic kind of ordering, while at about 130 Kelvin, while yttrium TiO3 orders as a ferromagnet at a much lower temperature, about 30 Kelvin. And I'm not going to really address the underlying reason for the different behavior of these two systems in their low temperature phase, it was actually one of the measurement of magnon dispersion in lanthanum TiO3 was one of the starting points for suggesting that there may be an orbital liquid in this material. And we actually think that the lifting of the orbital degeneracy makes it qualitatively reasonable that it is an antiferromagnet, despite the fact that it has sort of locally octahedral environment. And this point was actually made also by Mochizuki and Imada. But there are still some mysteries that remain about the low temperature state that I don't want to enter too much in this talk. Of course, if we do electronic structure calculations, we're going to find that all of these systems are metallic. This is very well known. But what's interesting is that this can be used as a sort of machine to produce at least the one electron part of the Hamiltonian for the low-lying degrees of freedom that we are interested in, namely the d orbital degrees of freedom. And this is, and also to assess to what extent this tilting distortion induces a significant split off of the T2G levels in these materials. So this is what my collaborators, Eva Pavarini and Zilke Biermann and Sasha Potayayev did for these materials. And they actually used a very nice tool that was developed in Stuttgart by Ole Andersen and his collaborators, and which is sort of a method in electronic structure which allows you to use local orbitals, so orbitals that we many body physicists like to use, but at the same time to produce an effective Hamiltonian for a very restricted set of bands, the ones that are that corresponds to this T2G multiplet and that are well separated from all the others. So it's basically a machine for producing well localized Vanier functions that are understandable and for producing a one electron Hamiltonian in this Vanier orbital basis set. Of course, what I'm plotting here is just the density of states, the density of states of these materials as obtained from these LDA calculations, and these density of states would be the same whichever electronic structure method you use. So here is the strontium VO3 density of states. All the three orbital components of the T2G multiplet are the same, so I'm just showing one of them, and you see that in this material we get the Fermi level to be right at the bottom of this band here. As the tilting distortion is increased, going to calcium VO3, lanthanum TiO3, yttrium TiO3, you see the gradual split off of the various components. And actually, if you look at the center of gravity at these various density of states, you will find that in yttrium TiO3, which is the extreme case, the center of gravity of the green guy as compared to the center of gravity of the red guy is as large as about a third of an electron volt. So the crystal field splitting due to this tilting is really not a small effect in these materials. This is basically a contour plot of these Vanier orbitals, but you might not be so interested in these, which also illustrates how the crystal structure is gradually, the crystal distortion increases from one material to the other. Okay, so if we actually compare this electronic structure calculation results to photo emission, we find, of course, a huge discrepancy in the insulating case. But even in the metallic systems, like here is strontium VO3, we find the well-known things that basically the bandwidth as produced by electronic structure calculation is too large, and the observed quasi-particle peak has a width which is about half of what is obtained by electronic structure calculations. Qualitatively, this is just the Brinkmann-Rice reduction of the bandwidth of the quasi-particles. and which is just about a factor of 2 in this metal, and the corresponding spectral weight is transferred to some lower Hubbard band here, which of course is not present in the electronic structure calculation. Actually, it was one of the very nice achievements of high photon energy, high resolution photo emission to reveal very recently in the work of Sekiyama et al. That we learned about right here during this workshop a year and a half ago, a nice quasi-particle peak near the Fermi surface, while before, because of the low photon energy that was used, the technique was very surface sensitive and was not really able to resolve that quasi-particle peak. Okay, so let me go back to some of these qualitative ideas that I was discussing, that I was alluding to before. First of all, there is this notion that the value of the Hubbard repulsion, the typical Hubbard repulsion that you have to reach to induce the Mott insulating state, increases with orbital degeneracy. And this is something that is very easy to show using even the simplest slave boson-like theories or more sophisticated techniques like dynamical mean field theory. It's also very intuitive physically that the more fluctuations you have, the easier it is to stabilize a metallic state. So the mechanism that is operating in these materials is that this crystal field splitting induces an orbital polarization, which basically lifts off this degeneracy, and that favors the insulating state. This is what we'll explain. Yes?
So the first statement is for fixed total electron density.
Right, absolutely. So it's for fixed total, yeah, you fix the total electron density, and you ask how does the critical U change as you change the degeneracy of the system. Okay. There is actually a cooperative effect between the crystal field and correlation effects so as to induce orbital polarization. By that I mean that if you have a certain value of the crystal field splitting and you have an uncorrelated system, you're going to distribute your electrons in a certain manner in the various levels, while if you actually go to the extreme atomic limit where you would have isolated atoms, of course you want to put your single electron just in the lowest level. So this argument just immediately tells you that if you start at the LDA level, let's say at the electronic structure level, with a certain amount of orbital polarization, as you turn on the effect of correlations, you're going to increase this amount of orbital polarization. Of course, in systems that have more than 1D electron, this has to compete with the Hund-Sohl coupling, which want to spread around the electron in different orbitals. But in systems with only 1 electron, this definitely will happen. And you will see in the following that actually this effect is very drastic in these materials, and that the two insulators that I'm talking about are essentially fully orbitally polarized. Okay. So just to continue a little bit with these qualitative ideas, in order to decide whether we have a chance for seeing an orbitally degenerate system, or whether the crystal field is able to completely lift off the effect due to orbital degeneracy, we basically have to compare the typical scale for this crystal field splitting to an energy scale, which in the metal is going to be basically the Brinkmann-Rice reduced bandwidth. And this tells you that as you increase correlation effects, as you get close to the Mott metal insulator transition, because this scale becomes small, it's enough to have a very small crystal field splitting to lift off, to have orbital polarization. Of course, in the correlated insulator, this is no longer the correct scale. The scale you have to compare the crystal field splitting to is probably something like T square over U, which will be, say, the orbiton bandwidth if you have the picture of an orbital liquid. So very qualitatively, you would think of a phase diagram which looks like this. I don't want to discuss whether these are crossovers or phase transition. This is really just meant to be very qualitative, in which here we have the strength of the Hubbard repulsion with respect to the typical bandwidth, and here we have the typical strength of crystal field splitting. And what we expect is that if we have very little correlations, we need to induce a very large crystal field of the order of the bandwidth to go from an orbitally degenerate metal to an orbitally polarized metal, while as we increase correlations, we need only to increase delta to a small value to get into the orbitally polarized metal. By the same token, we are going to reduce considerably the critical value of U, which is requested to go into the insulating state. If we are in this regime, we are going to have a critical value of U, which is that of the non-degenerate band, while if we have perfect cubic symmetry, if we have zero crystal field, we will have a higher value of U, which is associated with the largest critical U of the completely orbitally degenerate situation. Okay, so can we be more quantitative in this system? Well, what we did is to use this combination of dynamical mean filter and electronic structure calculations. I'm not going to describe this technique in this talk. Basically, dynamical mean filter is a method to solve these Hubbard-like, say, Hamiltonians, in which one replaces the full lattice by an atom coupled to a bath in a self-consistent manner, so one has a quantum impurity problem that is being solved. And the developments that have happened in this field over the past few years is that this can be embedded in a sort of semi-realistic way in using this ab initio constructed one-electron Hamiltonian as a starting point. So one basically starts from this minimal Hamiltonian in this set of localized Vanier orbitals. You uses this in the DMFT framework to make a calculation for these materials. So I'm not going to talk too much about the technique. Let me show you some of the results. So when we...
Self-connect is still local, right? The impurity process is still local.
Right, absolutely. Actually, in the second part of the talk, you're going to see a non-local self-energy. But this one will remain local, because I believe for this system it's probably okay. Yes?
So you take the same electrons in the same different orbitals. How realistic?
For what?
Electrons in the same orbital and in the focal.
No, we don't do that.
But you have just one.
We have U and J, right? So we have here U, which is the Coulomb repulsion for putting two electrons with antiparallel spin in the same orbital. And when we put them in two different orbitals of the same multiplet, we have the Hund's rule exchange, which decreases U, okay? So basically, there are well-known Hubbard-Kanamori rules that tell you how to construct this UMM prime matrix. So we do include the Hund's rule effect.
J is the Hund's coupling?
J is the Hund's coupling here. I'm sorry, I should have called it JH. It's definitely the Hund's rule coupling. And the point is that even though in this method one has to admit that these can be considered in some sense as parameters, that you can either estimate from electronic structure calculations or take from experimentally observed spectra. Nevertheless, since these materials are basically very similar, we need to explain the behavior of these various materials with similar values of the parameters. And actually, we've taken just the same for all four compounds here. So what is demonstrated here is that when you do such a calculation for these four materials, you actually get correctly these two materials to be very similar and to be correlated metals with a bandwidth reduction which is about half, and these two materials to be insulators with quite different gaps, which are in very good agreement in very reasonable agreement with experiments. And the driving force again behind that is basically this lifting of the orbital degeneracy. This is a comparison, in fact, between the photoemission spectra of Sekiyama and co-workers and these calculations. And you see that this comparison actually works pretty well. And the punchline, basically, of what we have done is that we find a very strong orbital polarization in the two insulating compounds. And this strong orbital polarization, for the reason I was explaining before, is actually increased by correlation effects. So if you look at lanthanum TiO3, and if you actually look at the eigenvector of the local density matrix, which has the highest occupancy, so that's basically a way to define which orbital combination carries the largest amount the largest fraction of the one electron that you have in the system. If you do that for the lanthanum TiO3, you find that there is one specific orbital combination which has about half of the one electron, and the other half sort of distributes itself between the two other levels. While if you actually turn on the correlation effects, we find that for lanthanum TiO3, nearly 90% of the electron is lying in this specific orbital combination. And for yttrium TiO3, it's even basically 100% orbital polarization.
Which yes? What combination?
That's the answer to your question. Okay. So actually, this is a pictorial representation of the type of orbital polarization that you find in this system. I'm not going to have a lot of time to comment in detail on what's being observed here, but this is the first time, I think, that within these techniques one can study the specific orbital pattern that comes out of such calculations. And we find actually a specific orbital arrangement within the unit cell of the material with its 4 vanadium per unit cell, which is quite different in the lanthanum and the yttrium compound. So we actually think that this explains the difference between the low-lying magnetic states, this one being antiferromagnetic and this one being ferromagnetic. The thing which remains to be done and that we haven't done, but this is on the agenda, it's a lot more challenging, is actually to go now into the low temperature phase, or at least estimate the super exchange interactions that come out of this specific orbital polarization. Okay. At this point, what has been done here is a calculation in which there is no spin ordering, so it's really a high temperature phase. Okay. It's a calculation in which there is no spin ordering and there is no translational symmetry breaking beyond the unit cell of the crystal, which already contains 4 vanadium. Okay, so this is the conclusion of the first part of this talk. Basically, the driving mechanism here is the lifting of orbital degeneracy. We find that there is a very strong orbital polarization already at very high temperature on the scale of several hundred Kelvin. So unfortunately, these, in our opinion, are very bad candidates for looking for orbital liquid states, but hopefully there are other systems. And there is definitely a challenge, which is to explain the observed isotropy of the magnon dispersion that Keimer reported on both of these materials in connection with this orbital polarization. And there is a very nice paper by Mochizuki and Imada, which basically, with qualitative arguments, find very similar orbital polarization than the one we found in these calculations, and claims to be able to explain this isotropy of the magnon spectrum. Okay, so I will now switch to the second material I wanted to talk to you about, which now has not only orbital and correlation effects, but also very strong structural aspects, in the sense that this system undergoes a Pyle's type of instability. And this is vanadium dioxide. So let me just make a quick crash introduction to vanadium dioxide. Vanadium dioxide undergoes a first order transition at about room temperature between a high temperature metallic phase, which has a rutile structure. I'll show you in a minute what a rutile structure is, and a low temperature insulating state, which has a monoclinic structure. And the interesting thing is that the insulating phase is non-magnetic. So it's a non-magnetic insulator, and this insulator is characterized by a very strong dimerization into vanadium-vanadium pairs. So for many years, this was regarded as an example of Pyle's type of order, in which you have dimer formation. However, this was questioned in the 70s by various people at Bell Labs and at Orsay, and then by Morten Silberstein and Rice, which actually suggested that correlation effects are quite important to understand this material. And what, as you will see in the rest of this talk, I think there is an interesting interplay between the Pyle's and the Mott mechanism in this material. Okay, so let me show you some fancy color transparencies that show what the rutile structure is. The rutile structure is actually the following thing. We have these oxygen octahedra, and they are now sort of edge sharing, so that it has a C-axis, which is like this. In this figure, it's pointing out of the plane, while here, the C-axis goes like this. Okay, so along the C-axis, we have basically chains of vanadium. The vanadium are the red guys here. And these chains are regularly spaced in the rutile structure. So the vanadium-vanadium distance is uniform along these chains. These chains are displaced in the neighboring one as compared to this one, and then this thing repeats. So basically, this is a view of the structure looking along the C-axis, and this is a view of the structure looking on the side with the C-axis pointing upwards. What's happening in the insulating phase is that there is a very sudden rearrangement of the structure. The structure lowers its symmetry, and so now the C-axis is like this. These are the vanadium chains, and these are the nominal positions of the vanadium in the rutile structure. What's going on in the insulating phase is that there is a pairing of this vanadium into dimers. So now we have a very small distance here and a much bigger distance like this. And at the same time, these pairs tilt, like so. This breaks the crystal symmetry. This lowers the crystal symmetry. And of course, this induces a very strong super exchange between the vanadium spins in a dimer that will play a role in the following talk. So if you look at it sort of superficially, it looks like a perfect realization of the kind of Pyle's transition in which we have basically presumably strong electron-phonon coupling in the metallic phase, and this induces this Pyle's dimerization, and the resulting phase is insulating. In fact, there was a very nice qualitative picture of the structure, of the electronic structure of the insulating phase that was proposed by Goodenough in the early 70s, and which goes basically as follows. So we have again 1D electron because we have vanadium 4+, so this is just 1D electron in a T2D multiplet as before, and the EG is basically empty. So in the system is not a cubic system, even in its high temperature phase. So T2G is further splitted, and it's actually splitted into two families of orbitals. There is one low-lying orbital, which is called A1G, but I prefer to call it D parallel, which basically allows the electron to hop very easily along the vanadium chains. So these is depicted here, and you see these are the oxygens, these are the vanadium, this is the C-axis, and you see that there is good sigma bonding between these vanadium orbitals so that the electrons can easily hop along this chain. So this produces a very nice, I would say almost 1D-like band, and this seems like an ideal situation for the Pyle's mechanism to take place. On the other hand, this system is not at all a quasi-1D system, and the reason is that there are two other orbitals in the T2G multiplet that point like so, and these orbitals have very good pi bonding in the transverse AB plane. So the electron can as well hop through this pi bonding, through this pi hybridization in the transverse direction, and the system is pretty isotropic. So basically, we have one orbital which does this 1D-like hopping, and we have these two other orbitals that allow hopping in the transverse plane, and they are called pi star by Goodenough. And the picture of the transition that goes back to Goodenough is that if we start in the rutile phase, we have this quasi-1D-like D-parallel orbital, and it contains a little bit more electrons than the pi star for reasons that have to do with the overlap with oxygens. And as we go into the monoclinic insulating state, the Pyle's phenomena takes place within this d parallel orbital. It's splitted into basically a bonding orbital and an antibonding orbital. At the same time, the pi star orbitals, the one that hybridized transverse to the chains, empty completely. The reason is that there is actually more overlap with the oxygens in the insulating phase, so that it's pushed up in energy. And as a result of that, now you have, say, two atoms per unit cell. You fill in completely the bonding combination. You have completely empty bands here, and so you have a band insulator. This is a very nice story, and I believe it's qualitatively correct in many ways. The only catch is that if you want to make this story more quantitative and try to do an electronic structure calculation for this material, it actually doesn't quite work. So what's going on here is what is depicted here are, again, the various components of the d density of states as obtained by electronic structure calculation in the rutile phase and in the monoclinic phase. And what you see is that, so here, this is the total density of states, which here you see that the EG levels are well separated. Here, this is decomposing this total density of states into its various components. So the black curve here corresponds to what I call d parallel in the previous transparencies, and you see that to some extent it has a Wendy-like shape with these peaks like this. It's not quite Wendy, of course, because it's hybridized with the other orbitals. And then we have the two other components of this pi star multiplet, which form this band here. And in fact, our single electron sort of is shared equally, one third between these two components, between these three components in the rutile metal. As we go into the insulating phase and redo such an electronic structure calculation, you see a very nice bonding-antibonding splitting, which corresponds to the Pyle's mechanism. So that's in very good qualitative agreement with Goodenough's qualitative picture. The pi star is indeed pushed up a little bit to higher energy. However, the Fermi level still falls into occupied, into the lowest bonding state. And electronic structure people have a very elegant way of saying this. They say that, okay, this is an insulator with a negative gap. By that, they mean that they almost managed to open the gap by the Pyle's mechanism, but it doesn't quite make it, and the gap is negative, it's like minus 0.1 eV. So this is actually the band structure. It goes back to a 10-year-old paper of Venskovich and co-workers, which show the splitting of the low-lying d-parallel band into the bonding and antibonding combination, and this is here, this negative gap. So basically, this is saying that just the Pyle's mechanism doesn't make it for this system, and we need something else. And in fact, this was pointed out many years ago on the basis of experimental results, both at Bell Labs and in Orsay, which demonstrated that with very little changes in these materials, one can actually see that there is a Mott aspect to the insulating phase. So what these people did is that they actually made substitution on the vanadium side, like Tom Rosenbaum also did for V2O3. No, you did oxygen substitutions, right? But basically, what they observed is that with a tiny concentration of chromium here, you can go from this monoclinic M1 phase to a different phase. And this phase is very interesting because only half of the vanadium atoms dimerize in this phase. So basically, you have half of the vanadium atoms that form actually untilted dimers. And the other half of the vanadium atoms form zigzag-like chains without any dimerization. And it turns out that this phase is also a good insulator. So this is a serious blow to the pure Pyle's mechanism, since we have half of the vanadium which sit in basically 1D-like chains, which actually have a response, for example, to a magnetic field that look a lot like one-dimensional Heisenberg chains. So this definitely points to the fact that the Pyles mechanism is not quite enough. And not only the Pyles mechanism is not quite enough, but it's very important, certainly, to account for the precise nature of this insulating state, to consider these dimer pairs. So in that case, we can immediately guess that if we go and try to do our favorite dynamical mean field-like calculations with just one vanadium atom, this is not going to work. And that connects to Shankar's question. We are going to need non-local self-energies. So what we actually went on doing for this material is to do a sort of cluster DMFT calculation in which we take a pair of vanadium atoms and we embed it in a medium. So it's a lot heavier calculation than before, but basically follows the same route, to see whether in the presence of correlations we can indeed induce the insulating state. And this works, and I think it works for a very simple qualitative reason that I'm going to explain now. So first of all, this is a single-site DMFT study of the rutile phase, the metallic phase, in which just one site is okay. And you see that the picture that one gets of this VO2 rutile phase is that of a moderately correlated metal. There is a little bit of spectral wave transfer to the lower Hubbard band, and there is some amount of Brinkman-Rice reduction of the band here. Unfortunately, the photoemission studies of this material are still somewhat controversial. Recent results by Fujimori in the metal did not see much of a quasi-particle peak, while results of Chiang and co-workers do find a nice quasi-particle peak close to the Fermi level. So this is certainly an issue to be resolved by photoemission experiments. Our results are actually in a lot better agreement with this picture. And when we go to cluster DMFT studies, what we find is that indeed we can succeed in getting this material to be insulating. But what's more interesting is that we think we understand how it actually becomes insulating. And basically the mechanism is that the super exchange between the two vanadium atoms in a given dimer help the opening of the Pyles gap. So I'm actually going to explain this briefly. First of all, look at these results here. These are basically the bonding and antibonding combinations of these d parallel orbital as obtained within the LDA calculation, these two peaks here. And in the correlated DMFT calculation, what remains of this bonding antibonding splitting is basically this splitting here. So you see that this splitting is smaller than the original splitting in LDA. I'm actually done in like 5 minutes. And what we believe actually happens is the following thing. Basically, the Pyles good enough picture is correct, and there is a structural distortion that splits the d parallel bands, pushes up the pi star orbital as anticipated. However, if we just do a one electron calculation, the other orbitals are still too broad. So basically, the caricature of this one electron LDA based calculation of the monoclinic phase would be something like this. We would have the bonding antibonding splitting between these two components of the d parallel band, and we still have this broad pi star band which allows for conduction, and the system is still a metal, doesn't make it really to an insulating state. What we believe happened when you turn on correlations is that there is a Brinkman-Rice reduction of all the energy scales here. Basically, this splitting gets reduced by the bandwidth of this pi star band gets reduced by a factor of z, which in a simple slave boson description would just be the square of the slave boson condensation amplitude. But the bonding antibonding splitting within a dimer is actually reduced too, but its reduction is limited by J. Indeed, if you do a slave boson calculation, the slave boson couples to the hopping of the electrons, so the hopping, the effective hopping becomes of the order of Z times T, but the super exchange, which is expressed only in terms of the spin carrying fermions, is completely devoid of any Boyk-Manreis reduction. And what we believe happens is that this limits the reduction of the bonding antibonding splitting, so this becomes of order J plus ZT, while this black band here gets reduced more by an amount of Z. And so finally, this allows the band gap to form between the bonding component of the D parallel band and the other components of the T2G multiplet. So this is a qualitative mechanism that we think is in good agreement with what we have in our quantitative calculations. This can also, of course, be checked in simple toy models, and this is what we are currently doing. And you see that basically the Pyle's mechanism is helped by the fact that the super exchange limits the splitting in that manner. So it's a sort of cooperative effect between correlations and the Pyle's mechanism. So basically, this is the end of my talk. I just wanted to show you a few materials in which we have an interesting interplay of orbital degeneracy, structural aspects, and strong correlations, and also to show you that some of these DMFT-based techniques combined with electronic structure and sort of interpreted with simple qualitative model ideas are help these days to describe what's going on in concrete materials and maybe on the verge of becoming somewhat predictive. Thank you.
So the first part of your talk, based on your calculations for lanthanum titanate, there is an isotropic effective 1D, one band model appropriate?
Yes, I think so. You have to be careful that if you want to have a realistic model for this material, you have to be careful that actually the unit cell has four vanadium and mm-hmm. the way these orbital points in these different four, these vanadiums is different on the different four vanadium. And you have to use this if you had to compute the super exchange from this. But basically, yes.
Oh, that's empirically, what I would say. My understanding was that the nail temperature was a lot smaller than the J deduced from the magnon dispersion.
No. The J from the magnon dispersion is about 13 millielectron volt. Is about is on the scale.
The same scale. Right.
So there is no. I don't think there is a big mystery in the value of the nail temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, so that's fine.
In fact, if I can comment more on this, I think in the light of these results, the thing which is really a little more surprising is that the yttrium TiO3 material is a ferromagnet. And with also very isotropic magnon dispersion. So probably this is now what has to be explained, and not so much the lanthanum TiO3 case, which was considered to be the more surprising one when the cubic environment was assumed.
I have two unrelated questions on DMFT itself. One is that you talked about this beautiful work connecting band theory with DMFT. Now, I'm interested in applying DMFT to disordered systems, and I know that's an open problem. There's one paper by Vladimir and Cotlier, which is kind of numerical technique. Has there been any progress on that, or what's your opinion? I haven't followed the subject.
Okay, it depends what you want to capture. The key difficulty there is to have Anderson localization.
Right, that's of course.
That's what you have in mind, I don't have much to say about this issue.
So that's still...
Unfortunately.
Okay. And the second question was that the validity of the MFT itself. In some sense, it's a high dimension theory, right? Is there any, I mean, has there been any progress on understanding it is in terms of 1/D? I mean, I understand there is no radius of convergence and all those issues. But it works, right? Empirically, it works. Do you understand why it works? It's like LDA works also, but when it doesn't work, we cannot do anything. You know, it's one of those things. It works. It doesn't work, we haven't learned anything. When it works, we apply, we talk about it. Is DMFT like that too? When it works, we talk about it. It doesn't work, we just stay silent. I mean, I'm not being facetious, you know.
Sure. No, it's a very valid question. Well, okay. So there are two sides. There are two sides. There are two sides to your question. One is, do we really understand why it works? And the other one is, what can we do about it when it doesn't? Okay. Well, let me understand the second one first. Let me answer the second one first. Okay, so we can certainly, in contrast to LDA, we can certainly do something about it when it doesn't work, at least when the correlations, and now I'm talking about the spatial correlations, okay, remain short range enough. Okay, so we can certainly include higher components of the self energy, non-local components, by doing, for example, these cluster extensions. Okay, of course, when your physics is controlled by a long wavelength collective mode, this is probably not the way to go. But when the physics comes from, like in this VO2 material, comes from just a pair of atoms, and you want to capture the local effect of the super exchange, this is fine. So one can systematically improve the local approximation. I don't know if you would call that a controlled manner, but at least a systematic manner. Now, why it works? Why at least it works in some cases? Why even the local approximation works in some cases? I think basically it works in systems in which the or at least in regimes of the parameter space of these materials when the correlation lengths are not too big, in which case it's reasonable to think that the non-local components of the self-energy fall out very rapidly with distance. So if you want to go close to a quantum critical point, this is not the way to go. But if you want to explain why a material like this oxide is an insulator at 500 Kelvin, then it seems to me very reasonable. Also, orbital degeneracy helps in
So, Anton, so this is VO2 is V1 system. So, in principle, yeah, you can have molten insulating state, right? So, without piracy distortion, what do you do see?
Well, I would still characterize that insulating state as basically a Pyle state. So, I would say the Pyle's picture is basically correct, except the bonding antibonding splitting that you get from an uncorrelated calculation is wrong. And more importantly, the reason why the system doesn't make it to the insulator in a one electron picture is because you don't have enough bandwidth reduction for these other orbitals, the ones that are transverse to the C axis. So this and we think we have a differential reduction. Both scales get reduced. But because the bonding antibonding splitting is limited by J, while the other one, the bandwidth of the transverse orbital, can get a lot smaller, this opens the Pyle's gap. But I would still characterize it as, I would say, a correlation-assisted Pyle's mechanism, if you want.
All right, so you cannot take this at but I don't want Pyle's to helps you know what is
ready. Right. I don't want to fight with words, you know. I mean, I think basically the bonding antibonding splitting is what's driving the transition, but that the energy scales, in order to really explain that you get an insulator, the energy scale need the help of correlations.
Can you use uniaxial stress to tune the orbital degeneracy smoothly?
Yes, actually, This is a very interesting question. I cannot do anything with uniaxial stress. You probably can.
the gaps are small, and the orbitals look pretty sensitive to the
okay. So actually, this phase diagram of VO2, this is not directly related to your question of tuning orbital degeneracy, but the phase diagram of VO2 that I showed, that was obtained by substitution of chromium, was also obtained by uniaxial stress, and the two phase diagram match. But of course, what would be really interesting is to find a system in which we can tune as a function of stress through a point where there is good orbital degeneracy, and there, that might be possible. I don't have a concrete example in mind, but I think this is very interesting.
Actually, I'm not sure about what the energy scales in the insulator are, but is it possible to sort of put magnetic fields and go from the piles insulator to the metal in these systems?
Oh, the energy scales are huge. Oh. Right. I mean, there are fractions of electron volts.
Oh. Well, it's possible that you need very large.
No more questions? All right. Well, let's thank Antoine and all the speakers for an interesting session. So I guess